Welcome back to Clinicians Brief, the podcast, the conversations behind the content. I'm your host, registered veterinary technician, Becky Mosser, and today we've got a big group of us here together. I love having multiple guests, and today I'm joined by Dr. Sarah Steen and Dr. Lisa Pullman. Thank you, ladies, both for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm excited. Today's conversation is centered around an article that you guys teamed up on and was published in the January 2020 Journal of Clinicians Brief called Progressive Facial Lesion in a Community Cat. And I was emotionally invested in this immediately just from the title. But before we get into the article and all that, I just want to talk to you ladies about your background, kind of how you got here, where you came from. So Dr. Sarah, I'll start with you. Tell me a little about yourself and, you know, where you are today and how you got there.
So today I'm in Bakersfield, California, and I work at Critters Without Litters, and it is a high volume, high quality spay neuter clinic. And I'm fortunate to work here and be able to do things a little bit additional into what we normally do, like what we did with this cat in question. I went to Kansas State University for vet school, and I did a shelter medicine internship there. And that's how I met Dr. Pullman.
Okay, so my next question that I want to ask you first before we move on to Dr. Pullman is, are you one of those veterinarians who knew your whole life you wanted to be a vet, or did that come along later in life for you?
I think it was something that I knew, but I definitely took a little bit of a meandering path to get there. So I have an English degree also. So it took me a few years to figure out where I wanted to be, but animals have always been a passion. I just didn't commit to it as quickly as some people, I guess.
Well, and the English side of this has tied into your journal writing, so we appreciate that you've got that background.
It has come in handy.
Dr. Lisa, what about you?
So I went to the University of Guelph in Canada. I'm Canadian. And then practiced for several years in small animal practice, and then did a residency in clinical pathology at Auburn University. But I also really got involved in the shelter medicine program there, and I was actually the faculty advisor during my residency for the shelter medicine program. And so that is a side interest. And then after I finished my residency at Auburn, I went on to become a faculty member at Kansas State University, and then got really involved with the Riley County Humane Society in 2011. And so since then, I've been involved, and, you know, great students like Sarah got involved, and she was a great addition. And then we've become friends since, and she's still involved. And so that's where I am.
And so what about for you? Were you a natural born veterinarian that come along later in life?
Very similar to Sarah. I took a meandering path to get there. So I didn't actually graduate from vet school till I was 36.
Wonderful. Yeah, I love that. And what was your first career?
I traveled with the carnival for a very long time, and I moved up fairly high in the organization. But, you know, 10 years later, I decided, okay, I've got to do something else with my life. And what is that going to be? And, you know, along the way, I had picked up a menagerie of animals and always loved animals and was always, you know, sort of rescuing them by myself. But yeah, so, and then decided to go to vet school.
Okay. Well, so we're going to have you back to have a conversation about all of the life you've had, because this is pretty amazing. But for now, we are going to focus this conversation down a little bit into talking about this particular facial lesion in a community cat. And so this story for me was like, it was a heartbreaker from the word no-nose, which is this little guy's name. And, you know, no-nose is a familiar story to us, I think, in the veterinary industry, what you guys call a community kitty, which I like the name community kitty. Everyone knows him and feeds him, looks after him kind of collectively, but he's not really anyone's cat and definitely doesn't let anyone get a hold of him. And I don't want to, you know, I guess, you know, here, spoiler alert, this is not really a happy ending for no-nose, right? So kind of fill us in on the in-between.
So no-nose was living in an area near one of where my veterinary nurses lives, and they're kind of in an older area of Bakersfield downtown. And there's multiple residents that take care of the cats around the area. And she had just been feeding her own cat up, you know, on the porch. And a couple times early in the morning, she'd come out before it was too light out, couldn't see, but could hear like a respiratory noise, if you will. Didn't realize what it was at first, thought maybe it was the wind or leaves rustling, and realized it wasn't really windy. Finally got kind of a visual on him in the bushes. So she didn't get a great look at him, but realized it was a cat making these weird noises when he was breathing. And then a few days later, she saw him under her car and she was able to get a picture at that point. And that's actually one of the pictures in the article. And it's the more scabbed over picture. So she took that picture and brought it to work and, you know, showed everybody. And we were like, wow, I wonder what happened. But from that point, she kind of went and talked to some of her neighbors and it was like, hey, I saw this cat. Have you seen this cat? And turns out multiple of the neighbors had seen the cat around and had been feeding the cat and were pretty concerned about him because he had quite a large lesion on his face. Definitely welfare concerns. And some of the neighbors were looking for ways to help him, you know, find some relief with that. And I think it became more urgent for us at that point because some of the possibilities weren't so great as far as how to take care of a cat that nobody could catch. And they'd already tried trapping him, multiple of the neighbors, with, you know, humane live traps and things. And he was a little bit too smart for them. So he wasn't going into any of those traps, but they knew he was eating and they'd see him multiple neighbors around the area. And so we had just, you know, multiple times tried to trap him, tried to corner him places, and eventually just ended up getting him into a feral cat den where we were able to transport him to our clinic and get a better look at him. So that's kind of how that happened.
And so when you saw an image before you saw No-Nos, mm-hmm. right? What was kind of your first impression or your initial thoughts between the image and his presentation?
She had told us that she was hearing this cat breathing before she got a good visual on him. And so I was, you know, saw the picture and I was like, oh, well, that explains why he's breathing so loudly. And also, I guess at that point, we were pretty more thinking trauma, I guess, really more than anything, just because it's pretty, you know, drastic and dramatic, I guess. And but once she had been talking to her neighbors, found out it was going on and they'd been seeing him with this lesion for months, I guess. And so then we were thinking a little bit more like, okay, this must be more than just an injury because it's not getting better and it isn't changing based on what they're saying. So,
okay. And you know, this just for the visual sake for people who haven't seen it, where this obviously is no tiny lesion we're talking about, right? So tell us, once you were able to get him sedated, what were you seeing when you got a better look?
So it did differ a little bit from what the first picture we got was. Like I said, it was more like a scabbed over lesion in that first picture. And then when we got him to the clinic or got him in the feral cat den, it was more of a, you know, bright red in color, not so much scabbed over lesion. Definitely very fresh looking, if for lack of a better word. And the lesion basically covers the whole rostral portion of his face. So from the medial canthi, both eyes, across his forehead and down to his upper lips on both sides. And then he has no, you know, visual, there's no picturing any part of his nose or the structure. There's no nares, there's no nasal plantum or anything left visibly. It's just this lesion. So, and it's, like I said, most of the rostral portion of his face.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, there's some amazing imagery in this article. So if you haven't already seen it, definitely make sure you take a look at this article just to kind of get the full image. It is really, I mean, it's hard to see, but it's from a science standpoint and a medical standpoint, it's really rather, you know, fascinating. And so obviously at this point, you guys make a decision, you know, that this is a quality of life issue, right?
Definitely. Yeah. You know, there was some of the neighbors that wanted us to fix him and that kind of thing. And I know that my veterinary nurse talked to them about reasonable expectations if we did trap him, even before we did trap him, just because she didn't want them to be upset with her. But, you know, living with this kind of intense lesion on his face can't be comfortable. And because nobody could handle him, it's not really something that could be easily treated.
Yeah, right. I mean, Ian, he's terrified. His quality of life, how he's going to be under so much stress while trying to heal, right? Because he's just not accustomed to being handled and being trapped. I mean, you have a whole cascade of issues for this guy, right? Mm-hmm,
definitely. Yeah.
Yeah, that's hard. But you have a whole community who cares, which makes sense. So I guess having this community, obviously, at this point, a diagnosis becomes somewhat important. One, for community health concerns. You know, two, we want to know what we're dealing with. So you guys decided to go a little bit further into this, yeah?
We did. Like I said, my nurse has some of her own cats that live outside. And so she was just curious if this was something they were going to contract. So we talked about that. We talked about, you know, exposure to she and I when we were trapping this cat and that kind of thing. And so, and also just because it's such a dramatic thing and it wasn't resolving, we did want to know what it was anyways.
Sure. And Dr. Lisa, at what point do you get involved with No Nose?
Well, Sarah sent me the image, the first one, the scabbed over lesion. And we were sort of thinking, well, is this fungal? Is this neoplasia? This is, you know, sort of after she had more history. And then I didn't hear about this for about, you know, a month or so. And then I got a text that, hey, we got the cat trapped. So that was my involvement in this. And then as a clinical pathologist, I was the one that got the samples to read. So
okay. And so it's really convenient to write that you've got this amazing connection. So you're like, hey, I'm sending you this tissue. Like, you've already kind of heard about this cat. And so you have this connection with these samples. So tell me, first of all, a little about the tissue preparation for, you know, the collection and the best technique that you want to use in these types of lesions. Because, and again, you have to kind of see the imagery to appreciate it. But this was pretty serosanguinous and contaminated lesion at this point, right? And at the sake of being crass, right? And I don't mean to be, but now we have a deceased patient. So this isn't something we're going to be able to resample.
Absolutely. So I think, you know, getting a number of samples is really important. So you can get, you know, impression smears and aspirates. So if we're getting impression smears, you know, you can get, people often think about just taking the surface of the lesion, and that may or may not be useful, just because if, you know, if it's really contaminated, you know, there, we expect to see a lot of bacteria on ulcerated lesions, and it may not represent what's deeper and what's the real cause of the lesion. And so if you're getting aspirates, generally that will represent a deeper sense of that lesion. And so generally for aspirates, I recommend, you know, 22 to 23 gauge needle. And I really like the woodpecker technique, which is just when you take the hub of the needle and you're, you know, inserting that into the lesion and then redirecting it to try to get a good sample. And then you take that hub of the needle, you put it onto the end of a syringe that is filled with air, and then expel that onto a slide to make your squash prep. And when you make a squash prep, generally, I like to say, you know, just drop that slide, the top slide, onto the bottom slide. You don't need extra digital pressure, and just pull them sort of horizontally apart, sliding them over each other, not vertically apart. Because if there are, you know, we don't know what this is. So if there's delicate cells in there, pulling them vertically apart can pop those cells. But as well, you know, there's always a possibility that different areas of the lesion can look different. There may be a lot of necrosis. So taking aspirates from different areas of the lesion is helpful to make sure that you get a diagnostic sample. In this case, and in other cases, it's good to take then a chunk of tissue to use for histopathology, and which you're placing in formalin. But before you put that piece of tissue in formalin, you can do an impression smear of the cut surface. And so before that impression smear is done, you just want to dab off the excess blood or, you know, serous fluid so that the sample will actually stick to the slide. So that really will be, those ways of collecting should provide you with a good sample.
If this was another patient, basically one to say that we were going to be able to treat long-term, would we have wanted to consider culture and sensitivity and susceptibility on this one?
Absolutely. Culture and susceptibility will provide, you know, valuable treatment information. There is some information out there that is saying that fluconazole, which is generally what is believed to be the treatment of choice for, have we set our diagnosis yet?
Not yet.
Okay. There are some resistance problems with this. So absolutely a susceptibility. And then also there are different variants that can have different prognosis and different recommended treatments. So
okay. And once you got your hands on this tissue, you had some time, the diagnosis you decided was?
Cryptococcus. So, and this was an absolutely beautiful sample. And I really had to give Dr. Steen credit, because she she made some really beautiful samples. And that was when I contacted her and I said, we should publish this because these slides are so beautiful. And then you've got the pictures of what no-nos looks like. And so that was really when we, when I contacted you guys and asked you if you were interested.
It absolutely was the answer, right? Because when you have that kind of beautiful imagery where it's just such a great learning module, and it was such a great conversation we were excited to have with you guys. Now, Dr. Sarah, I'm assuming this was on your list of differentials in the first place.
It definitely was, but you know, we couldn't rule out neoplasia and those kinds of things either. But you know, to be completely honest with you, once we got to the clinic, and actually before we had euthanized him, we anesthetized him, and I called Dr. Pullman and I said, help me, you know, we want to know what this is. And I described it to her, and she was pretty sure at that point, just because the lesion is so right on with what you would expect to see for a cryptococcal infection. And so at that point, she walked me through ideal preparations for that. And that's probably why the samples were so good. But
well, okay, to that point, though, you know, this isn't the only way cryptococcus manifests, right? And so what is the pathogenesis here of this condition and the other ways we may see it manifest?
Well, I mean, first of all, pathogenesis, it's going to depend on a number of things on how things go, but it, you know, it's going to depend on the size of the inoculum, the virulence of the strain, and then host immunity, even though we also know that FIV and FELV status don't really, there's not an increased incidence in those cats. But basically, you know, the encapsulated spores from the environment, these are called the Basidia spores, and they are typically inhaled. And so then infection is initiated in the nasal cavity. What's really interesting is that exposure to this organism can occur a long time before clinical disease occurs. And so, you know, years before, and then it can be activated or instigated with illness or immunosuppressive therapy drugs. Or so in that regard, it doesn't have to necessarily be given it or develop at a certain time point. After the infection is established, though, okay, and then it establishes locally, then it can spread hematologically to other sites. It can spread to the lymph nodes. It has a predilection site or predilection to go to the nervous system, often goes to the eyes and the skin. So that's really depending on how, you know, at what point you identify the disease in the animal, when do they present to you? It might present as just, you know, an upper respiratory that, you know, is not responding to treatment and then is continuing to get worse, or they could, you know, in worst cases present with neurologic signs. So it really can vary. You may see again that classic nasal swelling that we'll see in textbooks, and that can be ulcerated or non-ulcerated. But yeah, I can go on because there's many different ways, but that gives you the range.
Sure. And just out of curiosity, was FELV status established for this guy? Did you guys look at FIV, FELV on him?
We did, actually. We pulled some blood right before we euthanized him, and we did end up running a test just for our own curiosity, and he was negative, or no antigen detected for either of those antigen antibody. And we also did notice some interesting things about his blood work, at least the tube that we can talk about, just that he had what we assume was a large buffy coat in there. So Dr. Pullman can talk about that.
Yeah. So with regard to when she took the sample, she doesn't have, Dr. Steen doesn't have a hematology or chemistry analyzer at the clinic that she's at. And so she showed it to me, and the buffy coat was huge, which would indicate most likely that he had a very high white cell count. And given the chronicity and the extent of the lesion, I'm not surprised by that.
Yeah. I mean, this guy, obviously this had been going on for a while for him, and his poor body had probably been pretty tired of this. And more than anything, I'm glad you guys were able to get your hands on him and do the right thing for him. You know, that's for sure. What about, you know, at that point when that kind of lesion, and we look at the transmission between the cats in the colony, what does that look like for you guys and your concerns?
So generally, and I can talk both zoonotically and animal to animal.
Sure, yeah.
This is not the tissue, you know, the yeast form that we see in the tissue, it does not aerosolize. And we generally don't think of Cryptococcus as being contagious from animal or between animals and people. Or so it's not really a zoonotic concern in that regard. Now, I say that with, you know, if let's say you're working with a patient, you know, you would always want to use gloves and such. And there have been potential reports that a cat scratch with organisms on it may potentially cause infection, but it's not like we think with, you know, this aerosolized fungus that is really easy to catch. And it's certainly not one that's in that area, but with regard to how you get, I mean, you're getting it from the environment and those spores within the environment. So other animals may get it because it's endemic in the area, but not necessarily, or we wouldn't expect it to be from that cat.
And what would, you know, you suspect this came from the environment for this kitty in the first place, yes?
Correct.
Now, you do reference a couple different species of Cryptococcus in your article, and in this case, you guys didn't determine the species, right? But can you talk a little bit to the various species and if there is any, you know, reason to identify them if we have a case?
There is. So the different species, the one that most people know about is Cryptococcus neoformans, and then there is Cryptococcus gattii, and then there's multiple variants within gattii that we are seeing. First, before I get into dividing those, I want to say that a lot of veterinary diagnostic labs still report out Cryptococcus, all Cryptococcus, as being Cryptococcus neoformans. And that is a little bit problematic because Cryptococcus neoformans is actually not the more common species in cats throughout the United States. So it is helpful, you know, for learning more about this, that, you know, so if someone gets the results back that it's Cryptococcus neoformans in a cat, then they could potentially contact the laboratory to see if they did a differentiating culture, which is relatively easy to do if you have the culture medium in the laboratory. So basically in California, gattii is just like the rest of the United States, the most common form of Cryptococcus, with the VG3 being most common, and then occasional VG2. These are the variants, molecular variants. And that's a little bit more important just because those variants do have evidence that they are less responsive to fluconazole. And so susceptibility would be really important in these guys to identify what will treat them. But the response to treatment is not as potentially good as some of the other variants.
Well, and I guess that kind of leads me down to my next question, which is the fact that these fungal conditions are not, you know, easy to combat in, you know, the best case scenarios. And so what are the current best practices on top of actually differentiating these species in treatment?
So we've kind of mentioned fluconazole already. So in cats specifically, azole therapy is the most common thing that we're using. Fluconazole and itraconazole are probably the most common. There are other options, but side effects kind of make those, you know, less chosen for cats specifically. Sometimes the approach is multimodal. You can add in something like amphotericin B. Fungal culture insensitivity, like we said, is really important, especially when you're choosing the drug for treatment, just because the sensitivity is going to give you the best shot at being effective quickly, which can be really important for these guys, depending on how progressed, you know, the disease process is. And if one therapy isn't working, definitely trying, you know, if you just started with fluconazole, switch to itraconazole or vice versa, depending on what you're seeing clinically. As far as best practices, obviously, we'd recommend checking antigen titers as you're going to make sure that you are getting a decrease in those antigen titers. And we like to see a twofold decrease in antigen titer, excuse me, per month of treatment. Treatment does tend to last somewhere between 3 and 12 months for these guys, depending on response to therapy and other things like how invasive the disease is at that point. And continuing therapy until you have a zero antigen titer is also very important so that you don't have recurrence.
Plum's Veterinary Drugs is the must-have veterinary drug resource. With Plum's Veterinary Drugs, your number one source for drug information can always be right at your fingertips, on your phone, your tablet, or your desktop, wherever you need it. To learn more and subscribe, visit plumsveterinarydrugs.com. So I kind of have two questions there, but what I'm going to start with is first of all, kind of that multimodal approach you talked about, one, just in the treatment of the cryptococcus itself, but two, you know, what are the other, you know, side effects that you're seeing and what are the kind of comorbidities that pop up with this here? So are you treating pain and appetence? It would just seem like if they have these oral nasal lesions, we've got some other things we've got to deal with.
For sure. And I think it is definitely going to depend on the lesion and the patient. Some, you know, this cat in question was eating, and although it's kind of shocking, he was doing pretty well. His body condition score was probably a 4 out of 9. So not terrible for a community cat and an intact one at that. So I think things that, you know, you kind of have to base your whatever treatment on the clinical picture of the cat. So if you feel like their treatment or they're painful, obviously we're going to provide pain meds. I think as far as other possible clinical things that could be happening, you might see some odd behaviors if they're having neurological disease at that point, they can become obtunded, those kinds of things. And so if the owner's willing to treat those things, obviously we're going to treat those things, but it's more, I think, an individual cat basis or individual patient, just seeing their specific disease and how it's affecting their life.
Sure. And okay, so then I guess kind of going back to the other thing that you were saying about the long-term treatment and getting clean titers on this, kind of along those lines and to that point, since these long-term treatments and, you know, possible side effects and then again, post-infection monitoring are so important and essential with these conditions, what do you do or what would you be doing to create an expectation for your clients in these cases? One, for increased compliance, but two, just for them to kind of understand, like, we're in it for the long haul here with this, and this is what we need to do to be successful, because this isn't like a, you know, 10 days and done kind of thing.
No, and I think this is huge because especially like we're, you know, these therapies aren't inexpensive and testing is not inexpensive, you know, and I think probably one of the biggest things that I will would want to discuss with an owner is what this kind of long-term treatment is going to do to the human-animal bond. Like, are these cats going to be able to tolerate this much medication, this much interaction, medicating with their owner? And is the owner, you know, are they going to be able to handle stressing their cat out, you know, trying to medicate these kinds of things, depending on how cooperative they are, if they're willing to just, you know, take it in some food or something like that versus having to give oral medications, you know, with restraint on a daily basis. So I think that's huge. Definitely laying out kind of a estimated cost plan for the short and the long term, depending on how response is going and that kind of thing, and foreseeing as many possible setbacks as you can at the beginning, just so that they understand all these things are possible. These are the things that could go wrong, you know, as far as side effects of a antifungal therapy with, you know, kidney, liver issues, those kinds of things. And so I think setting the client up to understand what a big commitment this could be monetarily and time-wise and those kinds of things is super, super important. And if you don't get that point across well, you might end up with a pretty unhappy client and a sad outcome to top it off, unfortunately.
Yeah. And I mean, I guess to that point too, how likely is reoccurrence? I mean, especially if we know there's an environmental factor here.
Yeah, so we do definitely know that recurrence is possible. Probably the biggest thing is having an owner that's willing to run those titers enough to be sure that we've gotten the disease or gotten at least the zero titer at the end of the treatment period, and not somebody that's just going to be like, well, it looks better, I'm going to stop. And I understand that response for sure, because if you feel like your cat is doing well, you know, you don't want to keep putting them through medicating. But understanding that disease can be subclinical, and we need to see the treatment through in order to fully resolve it. And there is definitely documentation of recurrence happening even like 10 years out post-treatment. And so that's definitely part of the conversation that needs to be had.
I think also to add to that is they get to a zero titer, but what after that? And so because there is the potential for recurrence, you know, the recommendation is to test a month out after the first zero titer and then 3 months and 6 months. And then I think if there is any clinical sign, you know, they could test early, but just regular titers so that they don't end up with severe disease if it does recur.
Okay, so I guess that brings me, even though I have this conversation, I think I could continue this conversation all day long, but I have to wrap it up, and it brings me to my Keep It Brief segment, which, as I always say, is very little pressure. We're very infrequently brief about it. You know, I guess what I want to talk about is this environmental factor with Cryptococcus, since we know it's in the soil and in the environment. Kind of talk to me a little bit about what kind of preventative measures we should be taking with infections. You know, how can we monitor and create safe environments if this is a concern?
I think, unfortunately, as far as preventing, you know, true prevention, there isn't a lot we can do. There are definitely cases of indoor-only cats getting this disease. And so I think the bigger thing for treatment and for, you know, good patient outcome is catching it early. And so if you're in an area where you know Cryptococcus is a possibility, testing early, I guess, would be probably the best recommendation we've got. Dr. Pullman, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, no, I think just also recognizing that, you know, we see upper respiratory disease in cats all the time, and there's a tendency to think it's just traditional upper respiratory disease, you know, herpes virus, for example. But especially as she was saying, if Cryptococcus is in the area, I mean, it's endemic, then that should be on the differential list to test for, and maybe elsewhere as well, but, you know, specifically there.
I think too, if you have an owner that maybe has been through a cryptococcal infection in a different cat or something like that, if they want to test, that's a doable thing. But I don't think screening, you know, as a general rule is probably a reasonable expectation.
And just to be clear, where are the more endemic areas?
West coast of the United States and Canada, it's most common. And then, of course, Australia is well known for it. I mean, really, Cryptococcus is all over the world, but those are the endemic areas.
Well, being from the Southeast United States, it feels like it's always us. So I have to say, I'm glad that, you know, it's always the bugs. You guys can, I guess, can have it out that direction. This is fascinating. And honestly, the story of No-No's, while somewhat heartbreaking, was incredibly fascinating. You did an amazing thing for this cat, for this community, to help them better understand this loss that obviously affected a lot of people. And you've made up some, you've made some incredible points along this conversation about, you know, just how we pursue this condition, as well as, you know, how we approach this with our clients. I think it's really important. So I want to thank you both so much for your time today and for the time and effort you put into your article, Progressive Facial Lesions in a Community Cat, in the January 2020 Journal for Clinicians Brief. Thank you both so much for being here today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks again to today's guests for joining us, and thanks to you for listening. If you enjoyed today's episode, you can find us wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. While you're there, make sure you subscribe, rate, and review. We appreciate if you leave us all the stars. You can listen to podcasts as well on our website at cliniciansbrief.com/podcasts. You can find us at facebook.com/cliniciansbrief, on Twitter at cliniciansbrief, and on Instagram at clinicians.brief. You can also drop us a line at podcast@briefmedia.com. Clinicians Brief, the podcast, is a Brief Media production, produced by Alexis Ustry, sound by Randall Stupka, hosted by me, Becky Mosser, with special thanks to production assistant Michelle Monkrez.